Live with Rudy Bachtiar.
سلام شنوندگان عزیز، من رودی بختیار هستم. امروز سپتامبر 22 هست 2019. از قلب لس آنجلس، نه یک کمی اونورتر، در استودیو سیتی لایو با شما هستم با دایرکتورم و کارگردان خیلی عزیز، همکارم زهره نگهبان. قراره هر یک شنبه ساعت 10 صبح با شما باشیم. من دلیلی که تصمیم گرفتم این کار رو انجام بدم، برای کسایی که منو نمیشناسن، حدود 20 ساله دارم در این کار حقوق میگیرم. 10 سال CNN کار کردم، چندین سال رویترز کار کردم، صدای آمریکا کار کردم، جای مختلف رفتم، از سوریه، جنگ سوریه، جنگ عراق، ایران بودم، اسرائیل بودم، مناطق فلسطینی بودم، رواندا بودم، ایتیوپی بودم. خلاصه سابقه خیلی زیادی در خبرنگاری دارم و دلم میخواد که این سابقه رو بیارم، این تجربه رو بیارم، به دوستانم در لس آنجلس معرفی کنم. چون در این دور زمونه که ما توسط تویتر و فیسبوک و تلویزیون و فاکس نیوز و سی این این حتی MSNBC داریم دچار عقاید خبرنگاران میشیم، من با چند نفری آشنا هستم که به اینا فوق‌العاده اطمینان دارم و فوق‌العاده کارشون همیشه درست بوده و همیشه خبرنگاریشون جالب و با احترامانه بوده. یکی از این شخصیتایی که امروز با ما هست آقای میجر گرت هست که ایشون هم بالای 20 ساله که داره پرزیدنت‌های مختلف آمریکا رو، رئیس جمهورا رو، از آقای کلینتون تا باراک اوباما، آقای بوش وسطش و الان دونالد ترامپ را کاور کرده. الان سینیر واشنگتن کورسپاندنت هست، سینیر چیف واشنگتن کورسپاندنت فور CBS نیوز و هاست اف هیز پادکست The Takeout و در ضمن برای نشنال جورنال هم کار میکنند و یه کتاب آخرینشون، چند تا کتاب نوشتن، کتاب آخرینشون Trump's Wild Ride راجب دونالد ترامپ واقعا فوق‌العاده است، خیلی قشنگ نوشته شده. Major, I've been singing your praises to our Iranian audience. We have a very educated audience here that also speaks English, so we're doing something new in this radio station. Welcome to our program, Major. It's so good to have you here.
Nice to be with you, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be with your audience.
Thank you for joining us, Major. I was telling everyone you're one of the most hardworking, respected journalists in Washington. I was also singing your praises about Trump's Wild Ride. It's truly a fantastic book, brilliantly written. Before we get to that, though, because of our audience, I have to ask you what your take is on the situation with Iran. One minute our president is locked and loaded, the next minute he's dealing, then he slaps on sanctions, now we're sending troops to Saudi Arabia. And Iran is threatening us with war. Iranians are freaking out. I'm an American Iranian. My American side is freaking out. What is our status with Iran?
Well, you summarized it brilliantly, and it's hard to come up with something that I could describe credibly to you or to your audience as a strategy or a plan. This has been true for a while, I think, and I write about this to a degree in the book, and I know we'll get to it later and later on. The early inclination of the president to side with the Saudi kingdom and place most of his emphasis through the representations of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, on the kingdom as a counterweight to Iran, and then having done that and having made that decision, not really having a follow-up strategy. And as the Saudis continue to prosecute the proxy war in Yemen with the Houthis, the president never really paid much attention to the consequences of that, congressional displeasure with that, the vast and enormous and ever-widening humanitarian crisis in Yemen as a result of that proxy war, and all the things that might be destabilized because of it. Well, mm-hmm. Now we're at that phase of destabilization. The Iranians, for lots of different reasons, are trying to get the world's attention. And by that, get the world's attention about the now defunct mm-hmm. Iran nuclear deal that the United States pulled out of, mm-hmm. and increase sanctions. And I've talked to lots of senior military leaders who say it feels like both nations, the United States and Iran, are in a box, different boxes, but unable or unwilling to find a way to ease these tensions and bring things down. But as you said at the top, you can't get a feel for what this is about or where this is going if you look at the president's words. 1 minute he sounds militaristic and threatening. The next he says, oh, you know, it's actually stronger to not do anything and not to do the military option. You know, and even as the Iranian delegation is trying to come to the United Nations for the General Assembly, visas are being limited to crucial people within the president's own traveling assemblage. So, yes, some big leaders are getting visas, but a lot of the other people who need to be there are not. So in small ways, large ways, confrontation continues. And to what end? It's very difficult, I would say borderline impossible, to get a straight answer from this administration. The one person who was pretty clear about, I'm in favor of regime change, uh-huh. John Bolton, unequivocally, absolutely, is now out. Where does Pompeo, the Secretary of State, fall on that? Where does the president? Where is Jared Kushner?
Who's giving our president advice right now? Who's in his head? I mean, we were literally 10 minutes, according to the New York Times, we were literally 10 minutes away from a confrontation, Iran, bombing Iran. So who is giving him advice and who's reining him in?
Well, it's an excellent question. You have an acting director of national intelligence. You have an acting deputy. You have a now brand new installed by just a couple of days national security advisor. But as everyone knows in Washington, the national security advisor may have been named Robert O'Brien, mm-hmm. but the senior directorship of the National Security Council has been completely hollowed out. Why? Because many of those who were in senior director positions quit when John Bolton was hired, mm-hmm. or he forced them out, having a very small contingent of only his most loyal followers and aides, people who had been with him politically and on policy for years before he came to the White House. Well, they've all left. So the National Security Council is effectively hollowed out. So that interagency process is broken. The defense secretary up against the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is not only politically but bureaucratically weak. Everyone knows that. And so you really have Pompeo, the president, Jared Kushner, and then an unknown assemblage of the president's friends whom he relies on for lots of different perspectives, some of them in the media, some of them not. But they're not part of any kind of cabinet or Senate-confirmed set of positions or people. And the president bounces around. And you don't. That's not an observation that you need to rely upon me to make.
Right.
Just look what the president says. He bounces around in front of the cameras.
Exactly.
His rhetoric bounces around.
Yes. And it's disturbing because a war with Iran would be devastating for the people of Iran right now. They're under so much pressure with the sanctions. They're also terribly under pressure by their own Islamic Republic government, which I will tell you is the first Islamic state that was created in the Middle East in 1979. Mm-hmm. And since then, the Islamic Republic money has been destabilizing the Middle East for years. In fact, nobody really talks about the fact that Saudi Arabia didn't really have a big problem in Yemen until the Houthis started getting training and money from Hezbollah, which was created by Iran in 1982. Mm-hmm. So we're in a strange place right now, aren't we, as the United States?
We are. And there's also this other component part of this, which we haven't talked about, which is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to form a government. Doesn't look like he's going to be able to. This long running, deeply
divisive.
This deeply committed relationship that President Trump forged with Benjamin Netanyahu is now subtly cooling off. Why? Oh, because Netanyahu is a loser in Trump's eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that was a driving force in this orientation toward Iran. And once the president decided, and look, I listened to this on the campaign trail. The president was unequivocal about this as a candidate. I'm getting out of the Iran nuclear deal. He put that before the American public to the degree the American public paid attention to that, prioritized that as a foreign policy development. He was elected. He has the right to do that. He has the authority to do that. There's no question about that. But what he also has the responsibility to do, and the authority falls to him, what do you do after you've done that? And what are the range of options for the United States if, in fact, the president's rhetoric is truthful about supporting the people of Iran, who he says are being abused and misused by the leadership? What are you doing to assist them in their lives and to make their voices, politically and otherwise, more relevant in that conversation? Hard to find any evidence of that on the U.S. policy side.
You're very honest in your book about the fact that before Donald Trump was in the press, became president, the press pool was used to being talked to a certain way. You write, perhaps even stroked. And you also call President Trump one of the most media-savvy political figures since Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And that's probably how he won the election. So how has his presidency turned the way you do your job upside down?
Well, in many ways. And when I say the president's media-savvy, and I get into this situation quite frequently, Rudy, as I think you can appreciate, anything you say about Donald Trump as president falls distinctly into two categories based on how people feel about him.
Mm-hmm.
If I say something praiseworthy, people who hate Donald Trump will say, you're just laying down for him, you're just a sycophant, why do you love him so much? If I say anything that's critical of him, objectively, factually, critically, Trump supporters will say, why do you hate him so much? I don't hate or love Trump at all. I have no emotional attachment to his presidency whatsoever. I hope that comes across in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I just try to take things as I see them and explain them based on my experience and this very unique place we're in American political history. So when I say he's media savvy, I'm not saying that's pro or con. It just is. And what do I mean by that? You mentioned Ronald Reagan. For his era, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan was a master of the medium of that time. What was it? Network television. It was not as thoroughly appreciated in the moment as it was retrospectively. I'm convinced 10, 20 years from now, whatever is said about the Trump presidency, on the media side of it, people will say, this person, this candidate, understood not only the instincts, the vulnerabilities, and the way to bludgeon the media into submission, but also work around it on social media in a way to relentlessly and constantly churn the conversation, more often than not, to his political advantage. And in doing so, not only frustrated his political opponents, but oftentimes brought them and their worst instincts to the surface, also to his benefit.
True, very true. You know, the calls for impeachment are growing for Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
and his actions really haven't helped the cause. I'm just going to read a part of your book out loud because, I love the way you write. B, I just wonder, you know, I put myself in your place. You've been covering this White House for as long as I've been working. We met when you were covering Bill Clinton. You covered Bush. You covered Obama. And now Donald Trump.
Four presidencies and five presidential campaigns.
Oh,
yeah, I've seen a few things.
You have. And you write in Chapter 7 about the firing of James Comey, which I think really it shook us because none of us thought that our president would do something so, I would say, obvious. You write, it began as a distant late-night rumble on the web, a single story about possible inaccuracies in a once lionized FBI director's congressional testimony. Hours later came an unexpected non-committal White House comment on said director. Then the earth seemed to shake and the foundations beneath the White House groaned. But nothing's happened. The talk of impeachment is there, but it doesn't seem that people have read the Comey, the reports.
The Mueller report.
The Mueller reports. It doesn't seem that people care that some of the very, what America is built on, what the presidency is built on, the values that this American system is built on. It seems that some of those values have been shattered by this president, and no one cares.
You know, when I wrote that, that's exactly the way it felt on that day that James Comey was fired. And that chapter 7, is entitled 10 Days in May, in which I describe the 10 days, the unbelievably intense, almost volcanic 10 days of activities at the White House and around the White House, kicked off by Comey's firing. And I will tell you, Rudy, I've had colleagues of mine who cover the White House come up to me after the publication of my book and say, you know, I wrote those stories. I covered all those 10 days. And this is now the book came out a year and a half later. They're like, I forgot half of those things. Did
Bravo.
We really live through all that? And I'm like, that's why I wrote it all down in one place, one chapter, 10 days. Basically, every highlight of those 10 days is there. And it almost seems impossible to go back and read that chapter that we all lived through that. And we seem to have 10 days like that appear with some frequency with the Trump presidency. Now, you asked this question about institutional strength. What is the strength of our institutions? I write about that several portions in the book, saying we're being tested. We're being tested as a country. What are our institutions? How strong are they? Why do they work? How do they work? And to what benefit? And to whose benefit do they work? This president is testing all of those limits and dimensions. Now, on the one side, does the president have the right to fire the FBI director? Absolutely. How do I know that? Because James Comey said so the day he was fired. President can fire me for no reason or any reason. I work for him. I'm part of the executive branch. That's true. So is that an institutional norm that's being shattered? Doesn't happen very often, but does the president have the power? Yes, he does.
And what Clinton did it, didn't he? Was it Clinton that also fired?
Yes, but he fired the FBI Director William Sessions after a very lengthy process
of numerous
investigations that established that he had made some pretty significant mistakes. And it didn't look like he was being fired on a whim or because the president was upset about the direction of an investigation. That was an FBI director had been fired previously, but there was a lot of sort of preparatory work at the institutional level to say there was something wrong here and the president needed to intervene. In this case, the president said on television within 2 days later, well, you know, I did this kind of because of the Russian investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. You did?
He admitted it.
Right. And one of the things that is, I think, worth noting about this president is what he does, he then explains in public and then says, those are my motives, that's why I did it, and like it or leave it. And because he's so willing to sort of look into the camera, look at the country and say, hey, take it or leave it, like it or lump it, I don't care. I don't care. That I don't care-ness for his supporters creates this great sense in their minds of strength and purpose and resilience. And for his detractors and his critics, I think it knocks them back on their heels. They don't know what to do with that. They're so accustomed to political actors being cagey and reluctant and like it's a double bank shot on a pool table. I didn't really do that. Somebody else did that. No, Trump says, I did it. What are you going to do about it? And that's the sort of a fundamental question. What are you going to do about it? And we have not, as a country, and I'm not suggesting we should, but for that question, what are you going to do about it? No answer has come back.
No answer right now. What do you make of the Kim Jong-un, President Trump photo op? I was meaning on that day to text you, Major, to get your take on that, because it's not like presidents before him couldn't have done that and gone and shaken North Korea's hand, Kim Jong-un's father's hand, or...
Right.
Or is it something that we need to do? I mean, this system of not speaking to dictators doesn't seem to help the people. Is it a step that we need to make? And was that the right time to make it?
You know, this is, and I write about it in the book, I have a whole chapter devoted to North Korea. And I say in the book, this is not only different in kind, it's different in purpose, and it's different in risk. And I mentioned that previous presidents had more or less done the same things and reached the same conclusions. And for President Trump, that itself means he's going to do something different. I mean, essentially, if President Trump has looked at a file, the file is what? Venezuela, Iran, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, whatever. And if in that file it says 30 years we've done this, right then and there he'll say, I'm going to do something else. Just instinctively, I'm going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump loves headlines. He loves headlines enormously, and he loves to generate headlines. He loves pictures. He loves television. He loves watching himself on television. Quick note to your listeners. Why does the president always talk to reporters on the South Lawn before he gets on the helicopter to go on Air Force One? Because then he gets on Air Force One, and wherever he's flying to, he gets to watch himself on television for however long he's on the plane. I mean, that's literally why he does it. He makes questions, of course. We learn things. But he'll go on for 45 minutes when most of the questions have been exhausted. Why? Because he likes to watch himself on television. Well, the Kim Jong-un part is a component of that. He loves to set things in motion. And then, what's the phrase we have all become utterly familiar with, Rudy, with President Trump? We'll see what happens.
We'll see. Now, and it's great.
Right. It's great. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Well, what has happened? Two summits and then a meeting at the DMZ. Has anything changed fundamentally in terms of the pursuit or possession of North Korea for nuclear weapons or its stockpiles? No. Have they stopped testing? Yes, but maybe they don't need to test anymore. That's certainly something that a lot of analysts I've talked to have surmised. Second of all, they're firing projectiles and they're rattling Japan and South Korea. Just a week ago, the president's top negotiator, Steve Biegun, told Congress, kind of elliptically, it wasn't a big part of his testimony, well, you know, maybe South Korea and Japan, maybe someday we'll have to become nuclear powers.
Ah.
So nobody heard that here, because no. There's a million other things going on, as there always is. But I guarantee, Rudy, in South Korea and Japan, ears perked up and eyes widened.
For sure, Major. Major, we have to take a break. Will you stay with us and come back after the break? Thank you.
Of course, of course.
به پادکست رادیو ایران گوش میکنید. 670 پادکست. گلچینی از برنامه‌های رادیو ایران. رادیو ایران. SoCalPersian.com.
Live with Rudy Bachtiar.
سلام شنوندگان عزیز، برگشتیم به لایو ویت رودی بختیار. من الان پای تلفن با آقای میجر گرت هستم، سینیور سی بی اس کورسپاندنت، واشنگتن کورسپاندنت. داشتیم صحبت‌های جالب راجع به ایران می‌کردیم و داشتم راجع به انتخاباتم ازشون میپرسیدم. Major, thank you so much for joining us. We had quite a long break there. Hopefully you got a chance to get some coffee.
No problem.
And listening to our interesting Persian ads, huh?
Very good. Lots of fun.
So let's talk about this latest whistleblower complaint. It's about Ukraine. How troubling is the situation that the president might have spoken to the Ukrainian leader and pushed him several times to find information against President Biden's against Vice President Biden's son?
Right. So we have reportage and we have denials, and we have the Treasury Secretary this morning saying we should never release the transcript. A few minutes later on the South Lawn, the president saying, well, we might release the transcript. So we don't know what we're going to know and when we're going to know it. We do have some allegations that sound very bad, which is a president suggesting or using the power of the presidency, possibly the power of the purse, and congressionally mandated aid to the Ukrainian government to say, hey, I'd like you to look into this because it's about someone I may have to face in a political election in 2020, and if you don't, I may withhold money that Congress has appropriated for you to deal with Russia. I mean, on the face of it, that sounds really bad. That's what is more or less alleged. That's what people fear might have happened. Two observations. One, I've been around candidate Trump since August of 2015, covered the entire campaign from that day forward, and every day of his presidency. And I will say this, and this is something, Rudy, that even people who love this president, believe in him, want him to succeed, will say publicly. He says things that are completely different than any other president. He talks differently. He acts differently. He sends signals differently. The way he sounds is so different than any previous president has sounded. He creates alarming assumptions, alarming fears, alarming either doubts or conclusions all the time because he's so different. He talks in a way that no previous president has. What are his motives? Hard to know sometimes. But that he does things so differently, and when people listen to him do the things he does, they can't tell what he means, how much he means, if he's serious, if he's joking, if he's trying to be intimidating, or if he's just trying to keep somebody off guard. He does all of those things, sometimes in the same conversation. That's not to excuse the president's behavior, because I don't even know what it is. But I do know this. When, let's say, people in the intelligence community are listening to the president, they get alarmed all the time. And people who love the president will admit that, because this president sounds so different. He could say, I didn't mean any of those things. This may have sounded that way, but I didn't mean that. And the person on the other end of the line knew I didn't mean it. Well, who's to know? And if we get a transcript of this, and as the president has said, it was all perfect and appropriate, and you'd have to read it in a certain way and assume a set of certain things to see it a certain way. Maybe the president talks the way we have learned that he's talked in these conversations about hush money payments for women who have alleged affairs with him. He never says anything explicit. He never says anything direct. He never says anything that is provable in court. He just sends signals, signals that people around him know how to interpret. That may be, in the end, where all this falls, subject to interpretation. Because if you interpret Trump one way, positively, if you're a fan of his, you say he does nothing wrong. If you're an opponent of the president, almost everything he does sounds wrong, is motivated poorly, and is a threat to the country. That's sort of where we are.
What is President Trump doing right, Major? The economy's doing well.
So I'm rarely in the position of any president of saying what they do is right or wrong, except in the sense, is it consistent with what they promised to do as a candidate, and have the results of those policies borne out as they said they would? In some ways, on the economy, this president promised to cut taxes, promised to cut regulation, and promised to use tariffs in trade wars. He's done all three. The tax cuts have certainly helped big business, certainly increased job production, though job production was on a upswing throughout the last 6 years of the Obama presidency. And we have a lot more jobs. We have a lot more people with job openings than people seeking them. That's a historical difference. So the job market is very tight, and as a result, wages are going up. Are they going up fast enough to compensate for everything else? No, but they are going up, and that's a fact. Stock market is also up. That's also a fact. All of these things are consistent with what he promised to do and what he said would happen. So on the economy, this president is stronger than most incumbents seeking re-election. We don't know the outcome of the trade war. We just don't.
And
I don't write about it in the book because the trade war internally in the White House was whether we were going to use tariffs. That
right.
did not get resolved in 2017 or the first part of 2018. It did after that, about the time my book went to press. That's been essentially the economic dominant story of the Trump administration ever since. Tariffs as a tool to combat unfair trade practices. Where is it all heading? We don't know. We have, in theory, a new trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Congress hasn't approved it. We're trying to work something out with China, the European Union. All of this is unresolved. President says it has no downward impact on economic growth or the future. Markets aren't so sure. If we fall into a recession next year, most economists I talk to say it will be in part fed by deep uncertainty over these trade confrontations. So I wouldn't say the president's economic record is mixed. I would say it's more successful than not. But if there's one area where the president as a candidate campaigned one way and is governed exactly that way, it's been on the federal bench. And the legacy of this president, one term or two, will be to change in a Trumpian direction the federal bench, not just at the Supreme Court, but at the district and appellate court level, exactly as he promised. and with a focus and a determination rarely seen in any other part of his administration.
Which has huge ramifications for America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because
on the women's issues.
Right. And when federal judges talk about this all the time, they say when Congress is dysfunctional, what happens? Then a lot of things are fought over and thrown to the courts. And the courts throw up their hands and say, look, there should be a law about this, or if this is a new policy area, Congress should intervene and decide what the country wants to do through its elected representatives and not throw all of these contested issues into the white-hot light of the federal bench. But that's increasingly what's happened and what has happened as a result. The political cast of the federal bench has become more routinely observed. That is to say, we now assume if the president's a Republican, then any judicial appointee must be a Republican. We never used to assume that. When I first came to Washington in the early 90s, that wasn't the assumption. Now it's assumed that essentially robed members of the federal bench are just partisans in different costume. That's a problem for this country.
It really, really has changed. You talk about in your book covering elections, and, you know, I'd hate to ask you to make a prediction for the next election since the night I was covering the election in 2016 for Reuters, my boss told me to go find sad Republicans, preferably weeping. So we all had it wrong. Any predictions for this election season?
So here's what's I don't make predictions about elections anymore. I rarely did before 2016, and I certainly don't now. Although, as I write in the book, and this is verified not only in my book, but in a book written by Anthony Salvanto, who's our head of elections and polling, we had a conversation 2 weeks before the election, and I said to Anthony, he said, what do you think? What are you seeing out there? I said, look, I'm not predicting Trump's going to win, but I'm telling you now, and you should tell everyone in this network and the conversations you have between now and election day 2 weeks hence, tell everyone, don't be surprised if Trump wins. That's as far as I would go. I said, because I see things out there, crowd sizes, enthusiasm, that's just of a different nature and different context to me. And if all these people and all their friends come out and vote, this thing could be incredibly close and he might pull it off. Well,
again,
I wasn't predicting it, but that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So I look at structural things. By our historical precedents, this president should win somewhat comfortably. Why? Because he's an incumbent. Incumbents typically win, number one, historical fact, look it up. And incumbents with a generally positive economic trajectory always win, especially when there's peace and general prosperity. Well, those are the underlying structural conditions. And yet, one thing I've learned in the Trump era, everything I learned before either has to be discounted or thought of in a completely different context.
Start all over again.
So I think now to myself, okay, let's turn everything upside down, because in the Trump world, that's not an unhelpful way to analyze what might happen. Because if you go by everything you knew before, you're going to be wrong more often than you're going to be right. So let's look at it this. Oh, incumbent, good economy, but lots of anxiety, lots of nervousness. Trump just creates a huge emotional reaction. There's tremendous voter registration and energy and activism in the Democrats. And where will the soft, mushy middle of the country go? Turning everything I've ever learned upside down, Rudy, good economy, a lot of emotional tumult, anxiety. Maybe voters say to themselves, you know what, I just want to be calm. And the economy is okay, so now it's not a real threat if I get rid of the incumbent, but I'll be calmer, so maybe I'll do that.
I don't know. I think we might be surprised. When I see the children, when I see my sister's generation, she's 25 years old, how educated they are, how angry they've become at the system, at the climate change issues, the fact that our president has rolled back a lot of these regulations and really everything we were moving towards in a positive direction through President Obama. Now he's, you know, kowtowing to the big companies. I feel like our youth might, you know, generate some interest. I just wonder.
I certainly think that's true.
I just wonder
that
who
goes,
of the Democratic
the activism of the Democratic Party and who are they energized by and what issues are they driven by? And I do think there are two sea change issues that I see bubbling underneath the surface that when millennials, I think unfairly criticized, demographic in our country. So I have three children who are millennials, and they work hard and they care about things, and they are not loafers and slackers and layabouts who are disinterested in their future. They're very actively involved, and all their friends are too. But I think two issues for millennials are going to change our country's politics and assumptions over the next decade. One is on climate, and the other one is on firearms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big issue, obviously, the issue of the Second Amendment, our right to bear arms. The other thing that I think is really big, Major, is immigration. I mean, you know, as somebody who is traveling all over the world and covering refugees and children and terrible situations, it just broke my heart to see our country, America, treating children and putting them in cages, not taking care of them. What do you think about all of that? Can that be a mover?
It very well might be. I think that issue, to the degree it moves on both sides. And I write about this. I have an entire chapter in the book devoted to the topic of immigration. And
you do.
One point I make is the president hasn't changed any laws, not one. He has not used the power of this issue, which he identified and spoke about with a belligerence and a consistency and a hostility we have not seen in American politics since the early 60s. George Wallace would be the last one, even though he wasn't really big on immigration. He was much more about segregation. But that issue of differentness and how that is suspect by its very nature. The president does that, but he hasn't changed anything. He hasn't changed any law. What he has done is change the enforcement and the prioritization. And everything about the way this administration deals with immigration is, if the law allows you to be belligerent or indifferent or hostile, do it. And that comes to detention, rejecting or questioning or assuming the worst of asylum claims, and every other aspect of immigration. On deportation policy internally, they have been explicit. If you, no matter what your record is, no matter what you've done in this country, no matter how long you've worked, no matter how many indirect taxes you've paid, if you are not with documentation, you can be deported for that and no other cause. Everyone should be afraid, and everyone should be constantly afraid. The administration has said that. I'm not making that up. Those are words spoken by this administration. It has completely recast not only our internal sense of ourselves about immigration, but our external image globally about what we are and what we mean to those seeking a better life on our shores. And that is a titanic change brought by one person and one person only, Donald Trump. And for his supporters, it is a deeply galvanizing issue. So it will motivate people on the other side of the aisle, no question about it. But it will also, I'm not saying equivalently, but it will be a significant motivating and turnout issue for Trump supporters.
Well, I have to ask you this. Of all the presidents you've covered, who has been your favorite? Do you have
favorite?
Do you never answer that question?
I never favoritize my presidents, and I never even favoritize, because I get this question all the time, who's your favorite press secretary? I never even do that. Because all of these relationships...
Who's your favorite Persian radio host?
Rudy Bakhtiar.
There you go. That's what I wanted to hear.
That's easy. I never favoritize presidents, press secretaries, or anything like that, senators, because it's all just business.
You are one of the actually most balanced... You are the most balanced White House correspondents I know. I wonder, do we have time to play this soundbite of you taking... President Obama to task over the Iranian hostages? Let's play it.
Yeah, I'll stay with you as long as you want.
Well, no, there are four Americans in Iran, three held on trumped-up charges, according to your administration, and one whereabouts unknown. Can you tell the country, sir, why you are content with all the fanfare around this deal to leave the conscience of this nation and the strength of this nation unaccounted for in relation to these four Americans?
The notion that I am content as I celebrate with American citizens languishing in Iranian jails? Major, that's nonsense.
One of my favorite moments of yours, I think those four hostages owe you their freedom, because he did, in fact, move to set them free, right, Major?
Well... So I had a long conversation on my podcast. You were kind enough to mention at the top of the show, called The Takeout, with Jason Rezaian, who was the Washington Post hostage in Iran. And I won't speak for Jason, but if you want to go to the show, he says, one of the best moments of my Iranian captivity was her was hearing about that question and hearing that you got the president so angry about our fate. And I've heard through intermediaries from the others that I mentioned in that question a profound measure of thankfulness, because not because the administration wasn't working on it. The administration was working on it. But as you know, Rudy, very well, working on it and prioritizing it and pushing it to the highest level of priority is a different thing. You can be working on lots of things. Some things are high priority, and then there are some things that are really high priority. Well, I can say this, and I write about this in the book. After that encounter, and the president lit me up, no question, and the way that works is I ask the question, you want to light me up? You light me up. You're the president of the United States. I push the question, you do whatever you want with it. But after that moment, in ways he never had before, every time the president spoke of the Iran nuclear deal, he mentioned out loud and by name all four hostages.
What did Major. He did, and I was witness to that. You are a tremendous reporter. Your book, you've written several books, but I suggest everybody listens to your podcast, The Takeout, gets your book, Trump's Wild Ride. Join us again, Major. Thank you so much. It's been great having you on.
Thanks.
And 95.5 FM HD3, Radio Iran.